Now, when we say people retire, John, you're looking very young and sprightly, so you must have retired rather early. You're working in financial services in London, and you retired in 2008, and you're still looking very well on it.
Thank you.
So you started out a new hobby, so I guess before that you were really, really busy with work.
Really busy with work, yeah.
So was this always doing filmmaking, writing?
It's always been a hobby of mine, yeah. Mm. But I think the genealogy has taken my life over.
Yeah.
And I found a cousin in Tasmania, actually, and I've got to put it down to him. He had 35,000 names in his tree. 20 years he'd been doing it. I went straight back and said, we were second cousins. His granddad, my granddad were brothers. So I just said, look, let's join up and see if we can get more. And he just come back and said, great. And we've now got 75,500, I think.
But that is amazing. Most people only go back about one grandparent or something.
But, you know, 35,000 names is a great start. Yeah. And once you've got any royalty in there, then it is a lot easier because that you can track those.
So tell us, because I remember seeing that programme, and I've forgotten the actor, where he's related to the King of England, which was very funny.
Yes.
I can't think of who he is, but it was a fantastic bit of TV.
EastEnders.
That was it.
Danny Dyer.
Yeah.
Edward the First, wasn't it? Which is the same. He comes through, 22nd great-grandfather. I think they say one in four of us relate to William the Conqueror, so it's 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And if you go back 2,000 years to Jesus, then we're all related.
Gosh.
So, you know, it's easy once you start. And once you find someone with 35,000 names in a tree, then, you know, it was great.
You've got such passion for this, haven't you?
Well, once you find some good names and you just kick on, you know, I found a link to America that opened. That's why we've really opened up now.
Yeah.
And if anyone's watching Jamestown at the moment, which is, I think it's on Sky Atlantic, if I'm allowed to say that,
then
some of the names that come through are actually in the programme, and you know, that's a good start as well. So.
Have you found anybody where you've looked at some of the ones with photographs or paintings, and you can see the resemblance? Have you?
I'm not sure anyone would want to look like me. So,
don't say that.
I can't say I have. No, yeah. I can't. But I mean, many of the women look like men anyway, don't they? So, shall I say that?
Maybe. Well, they won't be listening.
In the old days.
Yeah. How far have you actually managed to go back?
I'm embarrassed to say, really. But again, John Drake out in Tasmania. We've got King David, 106th great-grandfather.
Wow.
The mind boggles when you get into it.
It's absolutely amazing. So who else have you got from that people will know your family tree?
The presentations that I want to go out and do, so I want to go out and do care homes and old people's homes, etc. The ones that I've got ready are, he says, thinking out loud, William the Conqueror, who's a 28th great-grandfather. Hereward the Wake. Has anyone heard of Hereward the Wake? I loved Hereward the Wake.
Way back, yeah.
But he was a pain in the backside of William the Conqueror because he was an Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah.
And he just, for 3 years, he really gave William a hard time. He died at 23, so he didn't last long.
Mm.
But he came home one day and found that his brother's head on a spike outside their house where they killed him. So him and one other guy went after the Normans, and they replaced his brother's head with 15 Norman soldiers' heads.
Mm.
That sort of thing. I find it all interesting. Yeah.
So brutal.
And the book you've got, which is the Farrar Chronicles, which is 400 pages and 800 illustrations, is a really lovely copy. But is that just your personal book?
It's really started out. It's just something I want to leave as a legacy, really.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in a few hundred years' time, when the Farrars are still looking, it'd be nice to look back that far, wouldn't it? That's there, I think, anyway. The internet has really brought this on, and it's the second most researched subject now.
Is it? I didn't know.
Yeah.
It's very important for people. You can see that when you see these programmes on television about adoption. People really want to know where they come from and their family. And it's important, even if you do know who your parents are, you still want to see the wider picture of why you might be the way you are, or creative, or is anybody else the same in the family, or as tall, or had the same colour eyes?
It really is interesting because you can get your DNA done as well now, which helps, I suppose.
You can, how do you manage that?
Ancestry do that.
They send you
far more than I.
Send you a kit, and but to be honest, I didn't get too much from the DNA we did because again, having the 35,000 names in the tree to start, and now 75,000, I mean, I'm not sure we can really find too much more going right back.
Yeah.
I'm now writing more of the current family, their life stories, because I want to leave it. And in 100 years' time, someone might be interested in reading what our kids were doing, or what I was doing, perhaps.
Community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Now I'm joined in the studio by Sylvia Kent and guest writer John Farrar. Have I said that? Do you know, I keep saying that name and I'm getting very confused. Where does it originate from, the name?
It's Henry de Ferrius rode with William the Conqueror, and de Ferrius changed to Derwent.
Yeah.
So it was Ferrius, then it was Ferrers. It's how people spelled. Right. Not many people could spell in those days, and Harry Everett got written. Yeah. But it ended up for us as Farrar, Farrar.
Yeah.
Or with Arthur Farrar, which is a story I'll tell you about.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk to her today. It's 1944, D-Day, 6th of June, which is today. So it's all those years ago that your Uncle Arthur was killed on D-Day. So it is today.
He was, yeah.
Tell us all about your Uncle Arthur.
Sure. Well, Arthur was... how can I start this? Today's the 73rd anniversary of Operation Overlord. Which is known to all of us as D-Day. So the story about Arthur is that he was one of the first, we believe, soldiers who was unfortunately killed on that day. The importance of this is that he's related to a very important person from France as well as England, but I'll come to that in a moment. But the overriding problem with the story about Arthur is his name, because on his headstone at the Bayeux War Cemetery, it's spelt incorrectly. And we're talking about how you say it. Farrar is F-A-R-R-A-R, but it's been spelt Farrar with an E, F-A-R-R-E-R. And it's taken a long time to try and get someone to listen to us to try and get it changed. And we've had no luck. Now, the story for Arthur is just before war broke out, at the age of 19, he was courted by a number of First Division football teams, notably Leeds United, which was akin to Manchester United, Chelsea or Liverpool today. And he had also been in the frame to play cricket for Yorkshire. So he was a very fit man, very, very good sportsman. Now, Arthur's nan, Maria, recalled that he had come to her house just prior to disembarking for the South en route to France. And he told her that he was not going to return. And when prompted as to why, he told her that he saw himself not returning alive. She said that he was quite adamant about this, so that he would be killed there. I mean, for many of the men who had been in that ill-fated landing at Dunkirk some 4 years prior, the proposed landing was seen as suicidal. The great majority of men gave little credence to the notion that the mission would be successful, granting the extent of the German defences and the fact that Dunkirk had been such a miserable disaster. So Arthur's aunt Winnie recalled quite strongly the sight of Arthur casting off from the house in Batley, Yorkshire, and it would be the last time that anyone, apart from his brother Jonah, would ever see him again.
Oh, dear.
And how are we just saying he wasn't very old at all, was he?
He was 19 when he left, yeah. Arthur and his older brother Jonah were both in the 1st Royal Hampshire Regiment, and they were among the first to attack Gold Beach. On that fateful day, one of the five beaches. He was killed literally the instant that he stepped foot on the landing craft onto the beachfront. At that time, he was 25 years of age, and we believe he was hit from incoming artillery fire at approximately 7:25 in the morning, which is when they went in.
Yeah.
As British officers led from the front, very few commanding officers survived the landing, and in fact, only 19 survived from the 200 from Arthur's unit that day.
Yeah.
Now, this is the interesting bit, because I find it apt that the Latin inscription at the Bayeux British War Cemetery would have a subliminal twist to our family, because if you translate it, it says, "We once conquered by William have now set free the conqueror's native land." Now, the interesting part of this story for me is that Arthur's 28th great-grandfather was William I, King of England, better known to us all as William the Conqueror. And you know, the inscription at the Bay of British War Cemetery relates to that. For a man born of blood that traversed the Channel in 1066 as William the Conqueror, it would be ironic that he would some 878 years later return to where their ancestor had courageously set forth. Sadly, though, at the expense of, you know, a man many of us would never know, and a man that they cannot spell his name correctly. And that says
that
it all for me.
That hurts you, doesn't it, John?
Well, it's quite frustrating. I've been really trying to... I can't get anyone to listen to me, it seems, you know? But we'll carry on. And I've got a two-year mission now, because I think the 75th anniversary will be the big one for this.
Yeah.
And that's got to be... We've got to get that done by in time for that.
Because you were in Bayeux just a few months ago.
I was, a couple of months back, yeah. I was in Bayeux, and... yeah, it's there for all to see. The strange thing is, with the forces, Arthur's name's spelt in four places. It's correct in three.
Yeah.
The only one is on the stone.
Yeah.
And all I'm asking is someone can fill the A in, make it into an E.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a new stone. Just the guy should have his name spelt correctly. He gave his life for his country, and he was related to William the Conqueror. So, come on. I mean, I'm sure William would want it corrected.
Definitely. We were fingers crossed you get that sorted.
Yeah, thanks.
And just before we're coming up to the news, the D-Day Dodgers.
Yeah.
Tell us about those.
D-Day, do you want to tell the story of D-Day Dodgers? Well, this is an interesting one. This involves my dad, really. I'll bring it in. My dad, Tom, was a D-Day Dodger. Dad fought in both North African campaigns and Italian campaign, and he was at Anzio and at Monte Cassino. They're pretty harsh places to be. So after finishing up in Tobruk in North Africa, the 1st and the 8th British armies headed for Italy, landing at Salerno. Now Dad was a driver in the 1st British Army, and they linked up and he became part of it. And there was the most interesting story to me is this one about the D-Day Dodgers. The name D-Day Dodgers was given to troops fighting in Italy and implied cowardice and avoidance of the real war in France. It was Lady Astor, an American and a member of Winston Churchill's Conservative government, who first called the men of the 8th Army D-Day Dodgers. It was in a speech she had made shortly after D-Day in which she said the 8th Army were all in Italy dodging D-Day. Apparently, Lady Astor had received a letter from a soldier who was part of the D-Day landings, who, tongue-in-cheek, said that the soldiers of the 8th Army were having an easy time down in Italy. So for some reason, Lady Astor took him at his word and he came out with this outlandish statement, her sarcastic response saying that the soldiers who went to Italy rather than Normandy were not fighting in the real war, and she called them the D-Day Dodgers. So you can imagine how upset the men of the 8th Army were. So they laughed it off and they got their own back with sarcasm as they composed their own words to the song that the German used, Lili Marleen. Mm. Now, let me explain my dad's involvement in this, because I remember one day back in 2007 visiting Dad with my youngest daughter, Lauren, who was about 14 at the time. This particular day, he said to us, "I'm going to sing you a little song in Italian from when I was in Italy during the war." Now, although I know he learnt a few words of Italian, I didn't know that he could actually speak it, let alone sing it. So he started to sing this song, Lili Marleen, and I must admit, I found this very strange. As why would soldiers from the British Army sing a German song? And then I remember at the time thinking, not sure you got this one right, Dad. But I never said anything as he began to serenade us both, and I think Lauren was quite impressed. Dad unfortunately passed away in 2009, aged 87, but in 2013, you can imagine how I felt when I found out about this story of the British 8th Army and the D-Day Dodgers. The story goes that the 8th Army were very displeased to be called D-Day Dodgers, and for very good reason. They'd already fought very, you know, huge battles in North Africa, El Alamein, Tripoli, Tunis, and then Italy, Sicily, Salerno, Anzio, Monte Cassino, and then the hard slog through the mountains to Italy. They didn't have it easy. Lady Astor was known to have said many things that she must have regretted. I believe she was the one who most once famously kidded Winston Churchill for being drunk, to which he countered, "And madam, you are ugly, but I'll be sober in the morning."
Yes.
And another accounter, she said, "If you were my husband, I'd poison your tea." And he said, "Madam, if I were your wife, I'd drink it."
I'd drink yes. it.
Yeah.
Now, they're good stories. And I, yeah. So I don't know if I can just, well, I've got a couple of verses here from the D-Day Judges, what they're saying. I'm not going to sing them to you, of course, because...
I can't sing.
But can I just say a couple of these verses?
Yeah, we've got about a minute, so go
right,
ahead.
Well, there's like, we are the D-Day Dodgers out in Italy, always on the vino, always on a spree. Eighth Army scroungers and their tanks, we live in Rome among the Yanks. We are the D-Day Dodgers, way out in Italy. We landed at Salerno, a holiday we pay. The Jerry's brought the band out to greet us on our way. Showed us the sights and gave us tea. We all sang songs, the beer was free. We welcome the D-Day Dodgers to sunny Italy. This one where they got their own back on her. Hey, Lady Astor, think you know a lot? Standing on your platform talking Tommy Rot. You're England's sweetheart, the nation's pride. Shut your ruddy big mouth, it's far too wide. That's from your D-Day Dodgers out in Italy. And the last one, the sad one. If you look around the mountains in the mud and rain, you'll find the scattered crosses, some which bear no name. Heartbreak and toil and suffering gone, the lads beneath them slumber on. Those are the D-Day Dodgers who'll stay in Italy.
Oh, she must have felt ashamed, mustn't she?
I think she did over her ears. But the thing is, my dad died in 2013, and I was 4 years too late in linking into that story because I would have loved...
Yeah.
He knew, but he didn't know what the story was. And so that's... and it's special to remember it today, 6th of June, aww. 73 years
well,
later.
Thank you very much for both coming in today. It's been fantastic
you're
to
welcome.
Meet you, John.
Thank
and,
you. No, thanks.
Sad, and also really. Nice to, and lovely to see you too, Sylvia. So we're going to cross over to the headline news and we'll see you again in about another 6 weeks.
We'll be about 6 weeks now, but thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Lovely. Okay, right, here we go. Just going up to the news right now.